Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, July 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Republican efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare have failed again.
I'm certainly disappointed. For 7 years, I've been hearing repeal and replace from Congress.
The U.S. slaps new sanctions on Iran. Could internet use in the U.S. be censored? Also ahead, an American pop star struggles translated into music. It's all on today's International Edition. After years of vowing to abolish former President Barack Obama's health care law, the latest Republican health care rewrite collapsed Tuesday. A visibly angry President Donald Trump expressed his disappointment.
For 7 years, I've been hearing repeal and replace from Congress, and I've been hearing it loud and strong. And then when we finally get a chance to repeal and replace, they don't take advantage of it. So that's disappointing.
Some lawmakers, like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, reacted to Monday's news by urging a bipartisan approach to addressing the health care system.
At the very beginning of this Congress, President Trump and Leader McConnell said, "Don't come knocking at our door on health care. We don't need you." Now that their one-party effort has largely failed, we hope they will change their tune.
Senate Leader Mitch McConnell did float a new idea of just scrapping Obamacare with no replacement plan at all. But several Republican senators quickly rejected the idea, as did all Democrats. Joining me now to discuss what it all means is Dr. Len Nichols, Director of Health Policy Research and Ethics at George Mason University. So what would have happened if they just repealed it and didn't replace?
In the short run, it would lead to insurers pulling out of the individual market because they're not going to trust that this Congress can work this out now that they failed twice. Look, Lori, I've never seen such unanimous opinion about the impending legislation coming from the health insurers, not to mention the rest of the healthcare sector. And essentially, the effort so far led by McConnell and the president have ignored all the professional advice. People are willing to work with them. People have always been willing to work with them to try to make it work. But they didn't want professional advice. So they're not going to trust the statement, "We're going to repeal now. Trust us, we'll fix it in 2 years." They don't trust them at all now. They've really squandered a lot of what could have been cooperation. So a lot of people would lose coverage. So there would be, I think CBO estimated something like 18 million people would lose coverage in year one. And so that's why it's a non-starter.
Meanwhile, the president says that if they can't repeal it, they'll just let Obamacare fall apart. What would that mean?
They could actively undermine it in a couple of ways, but what he expects is what the Republican leadership has been telling their base forever, and that is that Obamacare is not going to be sustainable as it is. And the truth is that's just not true. Medicaid expansions would go on without change, except for those states that had triggers to stop. In many states, they would continue. The individual market has its troubles in Minnesota and Alaska and a couple of other places, but in a lot of places like Virginia and California, it's doing fine. So the administration could undermine it, which is what they would probably try to do and blame that on Obamacare. But I think you've seen the polling like everybody else has, including the White House, I'm sure. The American people know at this point if this thing falls apart, it's on the Republican watch, and so they'll be blamed. And, you know, 3/4 of the people think it's Republican responsibility now. And it would be the height of irresponsibility to try to destroy it when you can't come up with a repeal option. The fundamental problem here is that they've been unable to resolve differences of opinion within their own caucus. And when you're trying to construct a bill with only Republican votes, you pretty much have to have unanimity in the Senate, and that's impossible. So what do? You have to admit you can't do that. And you have to admit that a lot of people want the best parts of Obamacare to survive. What the American population has overwhelmingly expressed is a desire to replace and fix, not repeal. And so they need to give up on the dream of repealing and work with Democrats to come up with a bipartisan set of solutions. Democrats are willing to do that, but only under the condition that the Republicans stop trying to take coverage away from 20 million people. And that's what's so hard, because Trump promised his base, don't worry, I'm not going to cut Medicaid. I'm not going to cut Medicare. You're all going to have coverage. We're going to take care of everybody. It's going to be beautiful and cheaper. Well, you can't reconcile all those promises with the conservative agenda that has been given first step in the House and now the Senate. So they got to basically jettison arch conservative dream of getting government out of this and work with Democrats to get something that would work.
Why do you think it's so hard for our country when most other Western societies have been able to tackle the issue of providing health care for their citizens?
So that's a really good question. It's the kind of question we ought to be discussing every election year and every midterm election year. And it cuts to the core of what are we as a people. Do we believe that all Americans deserve access to the health care they need to thrive in the modern world? Or do we believe that only some of us deserve that? And that fundamental divide is where I would say the majority of the people, and certainly the majority of Democrats, differ from the conservative Republicans. Not all Republicans, just the arch conservative Republicans, but they have been gaining ground within their party, and their party would apparently reject coverage of all. And other countries a very long time ago reached the consensus that, you know what, we're going to take care of all our citizens, and that requires us to agree that some of us will pay more than we absolutely have to so that everyone can have access to basic care, which, by the way, makes our society stronger and our economies better because it enables our population to really reach their potential. We have not reached a sufficient consensus to get there. And unfortunately, the way the Obamacare debate played out in many ways made it worse, because we got more polarized than we should have been. And you could blame anybody you want, but anyway, there we are. And what we need, of course, is a president who will actually tell the truth and speak honestly to the American people. Look, if we're going to do this, it's going to cost money, and here's who should pay, and here's who could pay, your choice, and let's have an honest conversation. There are people in both parties, I know, in the Senate and even in the House, who are willing to have that conversation, but for them to do it, leadership has to create the space for that conversation, and this president thus far has not been interested in creating that space.
All right, Dr. Len Nichols, we appreciate your perspective. He's the Director of Health Policy Research and Ethics at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The wife of an American student, quote, unjustly imprisoned in Iran, calls for his release. Trump and Putin met twice at the G20. The U.S. says the second encounter was a brief conversation. The U.S. House approves a delay of Obama-era smog regulations. Venezuela dismisses Trump's threat of new sanctions. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States slapped sanctions on 18 Iranian individuals and groups it accuses of backing Tehran's ballistic missile program, even after the U.S. recertified Iranian compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert said Iran remains one of the most dangerous threats to the United States and a threat to the Middle East region.
Ballistic missile development and proliferation, support to terrorism and militancy, it's complicit in the Assad regime's atrocities against its own people, unrelenting hostility to Israel that continues and has continued for quite some time. They have consistently threatened freedom of navigation, especially in the Persian Gulf, cyber attacks on the United States, and I can go on. I mean, these are no surprise, and this is something that this administration wants to get Iran to try to adhere to the spirit of that agreement.
Well, the sanctions freeze any assets the targeted Iranians might have in the U.S. and block Americans from doing business with them. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal for his view on the U.S. actions.
I think what is important to remember is that the United States obviously has implicitly contradictory objectives in the region as far as Iran is concerned. Now, because of that, it's inevitable that when you do one thing which may be considered as positive, as in the case of the nuclear agreement and its ratification, there is a problem on the other hand. The problem is that the American and the Iranian interests do not converge on other issues. And for that reason, the American position and the American decisions will have a fairly significant impact, not a short-term impact, but certainly a much longer impact. The impact will be of the following nature. Remember that the Iranians were looking forward to easing of economic restrictions and opening up of the American investors going into Iran for investment purposes, and other European and other investors who usually look at the United States for a cue before they go in. So under the circumstances, my concern is these actions that have been taken are going to have two-pronged effects. One is going to discourage capital inflows into Iran. Number two, it's going to make domestic investment even weaker than it is likely to be. Now, under these circumstances, Iran, which is already on a fairly low growth trajectory, is going to get onto even a lesser growth trajectory, which is dangerous for several reasons. One of those is that it tends to increase income inequality and a political dichotomy in the region, in the country particularly. What happens is that the more powerful, the ultra-conservative, get an excuse for continuing to maintain their anti-American and anti-Western attitude. But that for me is will weaken the new government, which has recently been re-elected, number one. Number two, they tend to siphon off even more resources out of the declining resource availability for their own purposes. And that means that there's a greater degree likelihood of a dichotomy in the economy growing and becoming worse, which is dangerous because it strengthens the hands of the conservatives and weakens the hands of the liberals. And therefore, liberals who could likely be considered as supportive of integration with the global economy will find themselves in a situation where they won't be able to do it. So under these circumstances, the forces that will be unleashed will likely be not particularly beneficial for the American longer-term interests.
The State Department said the U.S. remains deeply concerned about Iran's malign activities across the Middle East, which undermine regional stability, security, and prosperity. Do they have a point?
Yes and no. Look, I mean, the point, as I said earlier, we have on our hands a very difficult situation. We have contradictory objectives. Yes, we certainly would like the Iranians to help the process of controlling the one nuclear proliferation, number one, and number two, help in the process of containing and controlling, eliminating the influence of the Islamic State. The point, though, is once you defeat the Islamic State, what happens? A vacuum is created. Who walks into that vacuum? Iranians are certainly much more organized, and they've got a lot more resources than others. And the likelihood is that Al-Quds and other forces which are under the Revolutionary Guard's control are likely to move in those places. So the point is, we have already created a situation on our hands where the Iranian position becomes stronger. And if the regional Iranian position becomes stronger, then we will have to act in a much more aggressive fashion in order to contain their impact on the American interest.
That's Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal. Facebook, Twitter, Alphabet, dozens of other major technology companies protested online last week against proposed changes to U.S. net neutrality rules, which prohibit broadband providers from giving or selling access to certain internet services over others. Now, changes to the rule are being proposed by the head of the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, appointed by President Trump in January. He wants the commission to repeal the rules that reclassified internet service providers as if they were utilities, saying the open internet rules adopted under former President Obama harm jobs and investment. Joining me now to talk more about this is Mark Grabowski, internet law professor at Adelphi University. So first of all, just explain to us what net neutrality is.
It's the principle that internet service providers such as Verizon, Comcast, Time Warner, etc. should treat all data on the internet equally, not discriminating or charging differently by user, content, site.
We have so many other things going on. We have healthcare, we have the Russia investigation, and this really isn't on a lot of people's radar, but it's a pretty big deal that will impact a lot of people. What is happening with net neutrality?
So the FCC, which as of Trump coming into office has shifted from being democratically controlled to Republican controlled. The majority of the commissioners are Republican appointed now. They are looking to eliminate network neutrality. They basically announced in May, they passed a rulemaking kind of a announcement in May saying that we're going to do away with Title II, which is what provides net neutrality, and they're going to take comments now, and in August they will have their final vote, which will formalize this elimination of Title II and, in effect, end net neutrality regulations. And this could have a significant impact on the Internet, on the way that consumers access and use the Internet.
Can you give us some examples of what the impact would be?
The Internet service providers could slow down or even block customers' access to some websites. If you're a company like Comcast, for example, which is a part owner of Hulu, then you want your customers to be subscribing to Hulu, not to Netflix. So it would be in your interest to slow down traffic to Netflix or to block the site altogether so that your subscribers have to subscribe to Hulu if they want to be able to stream video. Or they could go and create a two-tiered market that would require content providers to pay an extra fee if they want an internet service provider's customers to be able to access their site without any problems. So Comcast could go to Netflix and say, if you don't want us to throttle or slow down or block traffic to your site, you're going to have to pay us $10 million a year. And they did do that at one point, actually, before these regulations were in place. And then finally, it's also a free speech issue, because internet service providers without network neutrality regulations could engage in censorship. And prior to network neutrality, ISPs demonstrated their penchant for doing this. In 2007, Verizon blocked an abortion rights group from sending a text message over its mobile network because they deemed the messages to be controversial. The same year, AT&T banned its internet users from making critical remarks.
Wow.
About the company. Now, both of these internet service providers later reversed their policies after significant backlash. But, you know, censorship is definitely a possibility unless you have network neutrality protection.
So you're saying that the U.S. is getting closer and closer to a somewhat of censorship with Americans using the Internet?
It could go that way, because without network neutrality regulations ensure that Internet service providers can't go and censor the Internet. But if you don't have network neutrality protections, then your Internet service provider could go and block certain websites or messages from being sent for whatever reason they want to.
All right. Mark Grabowski, Internet law professor at Adelphi University. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now with what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. What's happening, Andrew?
Lots to talk about. Social media stories around the world making headlines. We'll start off in Saudi Arabia, one of the strictest countries in the world as far as women are concerned, as far as dress code, how they can act, what they can and can't do. Mm-hmm. And there's a woman in Saudi Arabia who is capturing social media attention. She's gone viral. She put up a video on Snapchat where she's walking around a fort just north of Riyadh, and she's wearing a mini skirt and a shirt that exposes her stomach.
Uh-oh.
Now, it's not that she's walking around in a crowd. She's walking around this old fort. Mm-hmm. It looks to be maybe kind of like a museum or something. So she's walking around, put this video up on Snapchat. It immediately goes viral as she flaunts the country's laws, and it's inspired a lot of different reactions across the internet. Some people wondering who she is and what might happen to her. In fact, a lot of people asking those questions.
I was going to say, I would think that would be rather dangerous in a place like that.
Absolutely. And some people are concerned for her safety as well. And some are calling for her to be arrested, saying that she flaunted these laws and she broke them, so she should be punished. Others saying that she's very brave for staring down these oppressive dress rules and going out in public like that. Well, we received word that the, according to state television there in Saudi Arabia, the woman has reportedly been identified and has been arrested because of that video. Now, it's unclear what punishments she might face, but there's a lot of global attention on this. So all eyes are on Saudi Arabia to see what they will do in the wake of this video. Wow. And I think if they do anything that's very harsh, a lot of people will be watching that and reacting to that on social media.
For sure. Well, we'll hope for the best for her, for sure. Anything else going on?
Yes. So we cannot stop talking about the 2016 presidential election and all of the iterations that it has taken since then. And in this case, it is stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. And that's because earlier this week, we saw Tropical Storm Dawn form. Of course, President Trump,
I know where this is going.
Yes. And we've seen in the past couple days another storm forming named Hillary in the Pacific. So two storms forming at the same time, Don and Hillary.
This can't be a coincidence.
It's a very bizarre coincidence that a lot of people are talking about on social media, and a lot of jokes saying that President Trump is going to be upset that there's a Don tropical storm that's fizzling out. Some people saying that Tropical Storm Don is going to fizzle out and then blame it on Hurricane Hillary. Some people saying that Hurricane Hillary won't be reaching into Wisconsin or Michigan, of course talking about her lack of electoral efforts there. So lots of jokes, but it just goes to show that 6, 7, 8, 9 months out from this presidential election, we still can't stop talking about it. And people are still finding these ways to bring it up, even if it involves something like a tropical storm.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. And now we close out the show with news from the music world. International Edition's Ira Melman talks to VOA Border Crossings host Larry London about a singer who has had her troubles.
Yes, she has indeed. Her name is Kesha. The full name is Kesha Rose Siebert. She started off about 7, 8 years ago with a hit called Tick Tock, and then got into a legal battle with her producer, Dr. Luke, over there were sexual allegations filed. And that went on for a few years. Even with her record label, Sony, she tried to get out of her contract, and that failed. So she's kind of been out of the flow of things for about 4 years now. We haven't had new music from her for a while, but she's back. The legal battles are behind her now. She said she's so excited and ready to resume her career. In fact, she's got a brand new album which just came out. It's called Rainbow. And so we're going to check out the very first single from her new album. So here's Kesha with a song called Praying.
Cause you brought the flames and you put me through hell. I had to learn how to fight for myself. And we both know all the truth I could tell. I'll just say this is I wish you farewell. I hope you're somewhere praying, praying. I hope your soul is changing, changing. I hope you find your peace.
So what do you think of Praying?
I like the song. You know, Kesha has always been kind of famous for a little bit of what we call bubblegum rock stylist sound kind of music. The Archies. There you go. Back to the 60s. She talks, you know, through some of the song. She sings through some of the song. And, you know, she's very earthy. In fact, the video for this was filmed in Southern California in a place called Salvation Mountain, which is known as a landmark for the psychedelic rock era. A lot of festivals took place there and whatnot. So she films the whole video there. She's an earthy girl, and I like her music. I like her songwriting, and she had her own reality TV show for a while. And she goes by the name Kesha, because that is her first name.
How would you classify the type of music of this?
Wow. She's kind of Alanis Morissette-esque. You know, she comes from that same style, that same vein, where there's a lot of music about personal influences in her life. Alanis used to sing about drugs and things that were personally in her life at that time. When she wrote Jagged Little Edge, the album that was huge and gave us Ironic and such. But Kesha's kind of in that same Alanis Morissette lane, I guess you'd say. And then there's a little glitter rock mixed in there, too, because occasionally she'll veer off and do something fun and up-tempo and danceable. So Rainbow, the new album, is kind of a mixture of all of those kinds of music. It marks her return, as I mentioned, after a 4-year absence. While she went through the legal battles with her producer, which were resolved, I guess the judge just threw a lot of it out of court and they just agreed to disagree, and which is sad because some of these involved sexual and emotional abuse. And so
we've seen battles like that end people's careers.
Yes, exactly. And we didn't think that she'd come back, but she is back. And I think the new album and the new music will be well received. So that was the song today, the first single off the album called Praying.
Larry London, the host of Border Crossings here on VOA. Thanks, Larry.
Falling on your knees, praying.
Hi, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early July, President Donald Trump announced an additional nearly $639 million of humanitarian aid for the estimated 20 million people affected by food insecurity and violence in Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen. Tens of millions of people are in need of humanitarian assistance as a result of the man-made crises in South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen, all of which are driven by violent conflicts. And in Somalia, where ongoing conflict is exacerbating the effects of severe and prolonged drought, said Acting Assistant Administrator for the USAID's Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance, Robert Jenkins. Despite the influx of aid that has helped to alleviate famine in some areas of South Sudan, and has so far prevented famine in Yemen and Somalia, the overall food security situation is worsening, and life-threatening hunger continues to spread in both scope and in scale. In all four countries, conflict has been the primary driver of humanitarian need. In Somalia, conflict has made it difficult to reach some communities in dire need of food. In South Sudan and Yemen, civil wars have destabilized the economies, crippled agricultural production and trade, and sent the price of food skyrocketing. In Somalia and Nigeria, the regions that have been beset by violent terrorist groups, Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa, respectively, are among those in the greatest need of humanitarian assistance. Through this additional funding, the United States can provide emergency food and nutrition assistance, life-saving medical care, improved sanitation, safe drinking water, emergency shelter, hygiene and health programs to treat and prevent disease outbreaks, and protection for civilians who've been affected by conflict, including both those displaced internally and as refugees. This additional funding brings the total U.S. contribution to over $1.8 billion in humanitarian assistance for the four famine crises since the beginning of fiscal year 2017, said Mr. Jenkins. We will continue to work with our international and local partners to provide this life-saving aid needed to avert famine and to support communities impacted by these crises.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.